Secretary Kennedy, it's an honor to be with you.
You too, Andre.
This is great. This is first of its kind interview for an international series we're starting in Brazil, and you're at this hallowed hall at HHS. One thing that I found quite amazing, Mr. Secretary, was the fact that you're currently commanding, based on the fiscal year 2025, an outlay of approximately $1.8 trillion, and Brazil's GDP is currently $1.9 trillion, almost the same amount. So you've been doing lots of reorganizing, reshuffling, and basically revolutionizing the intricacies of HHS. Based on that, what have you learned from being in government these 6 to 7 months at this point, balancing critique from the outside once you were back when you were an attorney and an activist, and now with real-world execution leading this department?
Well, it's a lot more fun being on the inside.
I'm sure it is.
But, you know, it's a, as you said, this is a huge job. It's the biggest agency in our government. We have twice the budget of the Pentagon. And we had, when I came in here, we had 82,000 employees. We downsized down to 62,000. During the Biden administration and the COVID pandemic, the budget of this agency went up by 38%. And so what we've been doing is scaling back. And, you know, what's curious is that the budget went up, way up, but the health of Americans actually got worse. So the money alone is not keeping people healthy. We need to really change the trajectory of this agency. And, you know, the American system of health is really a sick care system. There's at every level, from the doctors, the hospitals, to the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, people make money by keeping Americans sicker. And today we have the sickest population in the world. More than 60% of our kids have chronic disease. When my uncle was president, I was a 10-year-old boy. It was 3%.
We're talking about 1960 to 1963.
Around, yeah. And today it's gone up to 60%. So about 8 in 10 American kids cannot qualify for military service. We have obesity crises. We have diabetes crises. The autism rates in our population, in 1970, we had the largest epidemiological study ever performed, found that about 0.7, so less than 1 out of 10,000 Americans had had autism. And today, the latest data from CDC, which is one of my agencies, is 1 in every 31 kids. 1 in about every 20 boys. In California, which is has the best data collection of any state, we have probably the most accurate, so it's probably worse than this, is 1 in every 19 children has autism, at 1 every 12.8 boys. And so we need to really change, we need to pivot at this agency and make it, and begin at every level, changing these perverse incentives which make people rich by keeping us safe, and align the economic incentives of our agency with good public health, so that people, yep, so doctors, hospitals, insurers, all get wealthy by actually making people healthier.
Definitely. I mean, these perverse incentives, Mr. Secretary, that you just mentioned, they are very much prevalent in Brazil as well. And both of our countries have diplomatic ties for over 200 years. America was the first country to recognize Brazilian independence, which actually occurred in 1822, but recognized it in 1824. Other than that, we have so many cultural ties that, but one of them that's really alarming is the fact that even though Brazil and America, with all these similarities, being the two largest population-wise countries in the Americas, based on distinct industrial, military, cultural, and health policies throughout the last decades, we've gotten really sicker, considering the scenario you just described very accurately. I think I'm going to offering this interview that we delve into very specific subjects like the anxiety crisis you mentioned, obesity, the sedentary lifestyles. It's very much similar and mirrored by Brazilian society these days. But why do you think you just basically gave us the diagnosis, but getting to the root causes? And right now, based on the fact that you have described this as the chance of your lifetime, the project of your lifetime, what are you doing to address these the root causes of all of these issues and these plagues?
You know, most of these diseases are linked to mitochondrial disorders. So there are environmental toxins, and really these are dietary diseases. Now, diabetes is clearly linked to diet. You can cure most diabetes. You can lose your diagnosis by changing your diet, by getting rid of processed
food. We're looking at 19 million Brazilians who are diabetic.
Right. And it's the same reason that we're seeing this explosion of diabetes around the world. Brazil Brazilians are increasingly relying on processed food rather than fruits and vegetables and meats and proteins that were part of the traditional diet. You know, 20 years ago, the diabetes rate in China was zero. And today, 51% of Chinese adults are either pre-diabetic or diabetic. And the reason for that is almost certainly partially because they built 20,000 fast food places in China. And they're importing more and more processed foods from Europe, but particularly from the United States. And it's not really food. It's food-like substances that are poisoning us. They're mass poisoning us. And, we need to reform our agricultural process, but also just our food system. And the diabetes is coming from ultra-processed foods, which are carbohydrates and sugars, different forms of sugars, which trigger the diabetes. And what we find is if people switch to a protein diet, that they can very, very quickly lose their diabetes or their pre-diabetes diagnosis. So, food is medicine. And we are, the processed food seems very cheap when you buy it in the market, but it's not cheap over the long term.
Exactly. Precisely.
Because it's going to make you sick. And whatever kind you eat, you're going to be sicker.
100%. But if I might, Secretary Kennedy, based on the drug prices and what HHS under your command has been addressing and proposing specifically on the most favored nation drug pricing policy, I'm going to tell you a quick story here. Recently, a great friend of mine who's American, he's been treated for Crohn's disease. It's an inflammatory bowel disease, as you know. And he was stunned to find that he pays $3,000 a month for the medicine he's prescribed here in America. And once he was in São Paulo, Brazil, he paid simply $400 for the same exact medicine. Many Brazilians, and I would guess citizens of the whole world, are kind of worried that this could push drug companies to raise prices abroad. How are you looking at this particular policy right now?
Well, the United States basically pays for global pharmaceutical research.
Yep.
So U.S. citizens, we account for about 70% of the profits for the pharmaceutical industry. We're only 4.2% of the world's population. And the reason for that is that other countries simply won't pay for it. And so the drug companies sell to other nations to say, we're not going to pay for these more expensive prices. And what we've now told the drug companies is whatever the lowest price that you're paying in any other nation, that's what you're going to charge here. And there's ways that we can do that. The way that we can do this is that most of the drugs that are purchased in this country are purchased by Medicaid and Medicare. These are government programs, so we can tell the drug companies we're not going to pay anymore. But we also want them to lower the price for the private market. And we have other tools for getting them to do that. We're trying to get them to volunteer to do that. And
maybe you got to push a little further and a little stronger. Are you facing some sort of resistance from Big Pharma particularly?
Well, of course. But it's not only the pharmaceutical companies, but the other countries have kind of gotten a free ride on the United States because they're getting the benefit of all of our research, and they ought to be paying their fair share. We spend about 8% of our GDP on drugs. And in Europe, they spend 3%. And so what we'd like to do is see them bring that up to maybe 6%.
And if I might even add to that, some estimates say U.S. consumers pay up to 300% more on drug prices than their European counterparts. I think that goes along the same lines that you were describing, right?
We spend a lot more. You can get Ozempic, for example, in this country. I think the list price is $1,300 a month. And in London, you can buy the exact same drug that's made in the same factory in New Jersey for $88 a month. And so President Trump has said this is something that has been bothering him a long time.
Sure.
And that we're not going to do it anymore.
In terms of the anxiety crisis both of our countries also face, the WHO has ranked Brazil as the number one most anxious country on the planet. Other than that, you've described the mental health crisis as the canary in the coal mine here in the United States. And particularly the cohort that has fallen the most behind in America are young boys. They're more likely to kill themselves, 3 times as likely to be addicted, 12 times as likely to be incarcerated. You also see teen anxiety and depression rising 37% among girls. And in Brazil, I mean, we have 8,000 cases per 100,000 people, which is just a travesty. Both of our countries are within the top 5 social media using countries. How can you draw a link on that, or can you describe that tendency for us?
I think it's tough growing up today wherever you live in the world, partially because of the food. And we now know, and there's a whole bibliography of emerging science that shows that that food is connected to mental illness, it's connected to suicide, it's connected to depression. And even at Harvard, there's a professor, Dr. Pollan, who has cured people of schizophrenia by changing their diet. And we know that dietary changes can have dramatic impacts on restoring mental health. And a part of it is there's just a...
Could you cite what are the most nauseous, depression-inducing foods?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons that we banned the 9 synthetic petroleum-based dyes is because they're clearly linked with ADHD, and there are multiple studies that anybody can find on the internet right now about changing diets in prisons and in juvenile detention facilities. Typically, if you change the diet to whole food in prison, the violence decreases by about 40%. And one of the studies showed in juvenile detention facilities that the suicide rate dropped by 100%, that the use of restraints dropped by 75%, and that infractions dropped by 60 or 70%. And violence, and all of these things are ultimately very, very closely tied to food. But you're right; it's not just the food. It's social media. It's the sense of alienation, of dispossession, that and the malaise that people experience when they detach from their communities. So I think the social media has accelerated and amplified the sense of dispossession that people have and disconnection from community. Addiction is really a symptom of isolation. The addiction is a disease of isolation, and part of the recovery from addiction is about reestablishing people's connection to their community, their relationships, their sense, their intimacy, their bonds with other human beings. And so, you know, there is a larger societal change that we have to work toward. And we're doing that in this administration.
How about vaping and contraband policy, which is also just incredible how in Brazil, Mr. Secretary, it has risen 600% from 2018 to 2023, the youth consumption of vaping. As you know, many Chinese-made vapes have been flooding the American market and American shelves. The FDA recently seized $34 million worth in Chicago. And in Brazil, our regulatory health agency, Anvisa, banned it in 2024. But teen vaping is just booming. The gray market is prospering. Is there any practical advice you would give Brazilian policymakers on how we can tackle that excessive use that's been poisoning our youth?
There's two issues. One is the Chinese vapes, which are directed toward children. They're very bright colors. It's cotton candy flavors. They are often accompanied by video games or other forms of entertainment that are directed towards children. And we're very worried about those, and we're now doing a crackdown on them nationwide. And it's the first crackdown that we've ever had on them, but we're being very, very aggressive about that. At the same time, we are fast-tracking approval of vapes that don't do that, because what we're seeing is you may know the fact that children that vaping has dramatically risen among children, but cigarette smoke has gone down. We have maybe 1% of American kids, 3%. Generally speaking, about 1% who smoke cigarettes, and the vapes are, they don't burn tobacco, and nicotine itself does not cause cancer. There's no evidence that it's carcinogenic. It may, in fact, have some health benefits. It's clearly addictive. It may have other health benefits. We have an NIH study that shows that it reduces onset of Alzheimer's and of dementia. And it's infinitely preferential to smoking. I think that nicotine pouches are probably the safest way to consume nicotine. Vapes are second, but the thing that we really want to get away from is cigarettes, because the cost to our country just of cigarette smoke, the healthcare costs about $640 billion a year.
Secretary Kennedy, you were one of the most outspoken critics of the official public health narrative that prevailed during the COVID years, and you were quickly branded by the vested interests and the mainstream media here in America, and the Brazilian mainstream media largely regurgitates and basically toe their line in calling you an anti-vaxxer. I'm sure you've answered that question 1,000 times before, but at least for the Brazilian audience that might be witnessing your words for the first time, how would you respond to that, and do you feel vindicated from all of the reversals in how we actually evaluated the nature and the impact of the COVID pandemic around the world?
I've never been anti-vaccine, but applying that, and I had all my children vaccinated, I received all my vaccines. But applying that pejorative to me of anti-vaccine is a way of marginalizing or vilifying me, and of silencing me and saying, well, you don't have to listen to him because he's anti-vax. And that same pejorative is applied to almost anybody who criticizes vaccine mandates. That doesn't make them anti-vaccine. Or who criticized the COVID response. And the COVID response was, I would say, appalling.
How so?
Because it was, I think it's clear today that the emergency was used as a way of clamping down totalitarian controls and of shifting wealth upward. The lockdowns, were the biggest transfer in wealth in human history. Trillions, tens of trillions of dollars in wealth. shifted from the poor around the world to, you know, to large corporations, to wealthy people. And then we saw governments around the world ending democratic rights and constitutional rights, and they've never recovered in most cases. Europe is a place where there's no freedom of speech, where they're arresting people or criticizing government policies and putting them in jail. So, you know, that's something that nobody would have believed 10 years ago, but it became a reality during COVID. And then the medical policies in COVID were a departure from the standard policies for pandemic controls that were published by WHO, by the European Medical Agency, by CDC, NIH, and HHS. We didn't do what we were supposed to do, which is, you know, never lock down a society for a respiratory illness. You isolate the sick, you protect the vulnerable, but you keep society moving, and the lockdowns killed probably far, far more people than COVID.
Do you think the disproportionate death tolls in Brazil and the U.S. Reflect these failed policies and these totalitarian impulses you've just described, or underlying health conditions that were already there of these two very sick societies that we've been mentioning?
I think both things are true, and, you know, it's going to be hard. You know, one of the most frustrating parts about the pandemic response was the information chaos. We were not told the truth about things, and the information tabulating and collection and analytical systems were designed to fail. And so it's going to be hard ever really parsing out what caused disproportionate deaths in some countries. I'll say this, that the lower vaccinated countries in the world tended to have the lowest death tolls. And I'll give you an example. And again, you know, you don't know because of the information chaos and the different collection systems and data in different countries. But in Haiti, the death rate from COVID was about 14 people per million population. And Haiti had a vaccination rate of about 1.3%. Oh, very few people got vaccinated, and yet there does not seem to have been a COVID pandemic in Haiti. Nigeria had a death rate from COVID of 14 per million population. In our country, the death rate was over 3,000 people per million population. So we are 200 times the death rate of countries that were essentially unvaccinated.
America, 4.2% of the global population, right, suffered over 1.1 million COVID deaths.
Represented. We had about 16% of the COVID deaths.
That's it.
In our country.
That's it. 16%.
And we have, as you say, around 4% of the world's population. So we did worse than any country in the world. Brazil was close.
Right? We were talking about 12% of global COVID-19 deaths, while making up only 2.7% of the world's population. So similar, right?
Yeah.
But if and when, and God forbid it does, the world, and once again, we witness a similar pandemic or even a harsher one, how have you been actually implementing different protocols in order to prevent that looking forward and that catastrophic scenario we all want to avoid?
Well, I mean, I would say one of the main failures during COVID was the almost complete failure to explore therapeutic options and off-the-shelf options.
Yep.
And we had a real opportunity because of the existence of the internet. There's 15 million frontline physicians around the world, and we should have been talking to them. We should have been saying, what's working in your country? What's working in Bangladesh? What's working in Argentina? What's working in Brazil? And harvesting that data and then telling the world, these are things that people are trying that seem to be working. There were deliberate attacks against hydroxychloroquine at the beginning of the pandemic and then against ivermectin later on. And those are two therapeutic interventions that clearly worked very, very well against COVID. But there are many, many others. And all of them were systematically attacked because there was only one solution that we were allowed to consider, and that was vaccination. And so we were doing nothing to take care of sick people. And in our country, if you went to the hospital and you were maybe having a little trouble breathing, but you were symptomatic of COVID, and you got a positive COVID test, you were told by that hospital, there's nothing we can do with you. Go home till your lips turn blue. And you can't breathe at all. And then come back here and we'll put you on a ventilator, which is going to kill you. Or remdesivir, which is going to kill you. And this has never happened before. If you even go to a hospital with the flu, you're going to be treated somehow. Yeah. But we were told, no, there's going to be no treatment. And then the lockdowns were irrational. You know, they were arresting surfers on the beaches in California and giving them $1,000 fines for being out on the water. Well, COVID didn't spread outdoors. COVID was spreading indoors. So they were taking people, forcing them indoors, where COVID would spread to the whole family. And so everything about it was not only wrong, but it was the inverse of everything that you would actually want to do if you wanted to prevent a pandemic. And you know, those kind of questions need to be asked. Why were we asking people to do things that, you know, were not in their, in the health interests of them or their, or the country?
In terms of food safety policies, I mean, what would you say is the specific one you're the proudest of, or do you think is the most promising one that you've already implemented right now in order to finally change the much worrying tendencies and trends of sickening Americans?
Well, I mean, we're very early on in the administration, but we've already done more than any other administration in history. We have commitments from 40% of the food industry to eliminate the 9 synthetic petroleum-based dyes. And that's a huge achievement. But also, we are encouraging the states to apply for waivers to the food stamp program so that the federal taxpayer will not be paying for it. We spend in our country $405 million a day on food stamps. $405 million a day. And about 12% of that goes to buying sodas. You're taking the poorest population and you're giving them sugar drinks that are going to cause diabetes. And so what we're asking the states to apply for waivers, and there's already been a half dozen states have done that, and we got 20 more that are in the process. And they're saying, okay, we're not going to pay for candy with taxpayer money to feed poor people. We're not going to pay for soda. And we're going to get rid of other foods that that are making people sicker, and we're going to make sure that people have an opportunity to buy good food for themselves and their children.
Hopefully Brazil will be able to mirror that to some extent. But Secretary Kennedy, if I might, the whole COVID crisis and the ensuing repercussions and ramifications.
You know, I'll say one other thing.
Please do.
Ultimately, the dramatic switch, a transition in our food supply to healthy foods, it's going to have to come not just from government, but it's going to have to come from consumer demand. But we can help that. And, you know, I'll give you the example of France. In France, 1/3 of the population has downloaded the Yucca app. The Yucca app, which is available around the world, allows people to go into grocery stores and put their cell phones on the barcode for all the different products, and it gives those products a rating. And then it will also offer you an alternative that is healthier. And what happened in France is it's driven consumer demand for much safer products. Right. And that ultimately is what's going to change the markets. It's if the consumers are saying, we don't want this anymore. And one of the things that, you know, my job is to inform consumers that this stuff is poisoning you and you better pay attention to it, and then helping giving them the tools. One of the things that we're doing in our country is we're right now making it your own healthcare records available to you on your cell phone. So everybody will be able to look at their healthcare records, and you'll be able to see whether certain things are certain changes in your life and interventions in your life and lifestyle changes and food changes are actually making you healthier. We need to put Americans in charge of their own health care and get them to stop relying on the government.
The automatic reaction to some is that it's kind of too expensive to have a healthy lifestyle, but considering these initiatives, definitely it has to be.
You gotta have the personal initiative. If you're healthy.
Exactly.
Precisely. And, you know, in our country in 1900, we spent, the average American spent 20% of their income on food and 5% on health care. Today, we spend 20% of our income on health care and only 8% on food. Well, we need to start recognizing that food is a medical intervention and that good food is going to be much cheaper in the long run than, you know, than the food that's inexpensive in your grocery store.
I mean, you hail from one of the most storied families in American life, the Kennedys. You're definitely the most relevant Kennedy in present day. You're the nephew to the 35th President, John F. Kennedy, the son to Robert Kennedy. President Kennedy used to have a great relationship based on mutual respect, not on charity and aid and submission, with President Kubitschek, who was responsible in the 1960s of building Brasilia, our current capital city. They were great partners back then. They actually started the Alliance for Progress in building economic development projects in Latin America. After your uncle's death, your father, Bobby Kennedy, then attorney general to your uncle, he visited the stilted palafitas of Salvador and the shanty settlements over there. There are just fantastic pictures from that moment. And the law school I attended, which is the Pontifical Catholic University of Rio de Janeiro, has a huge statuesque bronze bust of your uncle right in the center of our campus. So there's a long story and just very considerable connection between your family and our country.
Well, I'll just comment on what you said. My uncle had a deep affection for Latin America. And he and, you know, President Kubitschek and President Frei from Chile, President Betancourt from Venezuela, President Yeris Camargo from Colombia launched the Alliance for Progress, and they wanted to change the relationship into a partnership relationship, as you point out, with Latin America. And before that, U.S. policy had been based upon a very pragmatic consideration of, you know, who was going to be the most anti-communist, because we, you know, our stature and our posture in the world was that it was a battle between darkness and light, between democracy and communism. And so, and it made the United States very vulnerable, our foreign policy, to a foreign policy that said, if you are a military junta, if you're a part of an oligarchy that hates communism because you don't want people to take your wealth, and we're going to support you. And we ended up supporting all the military dictatorships and the, you know, these oligarchical, really semi-feudal systems, which they had in your country. My father visited, by then I think President Goulart was
right before the military movement in 1964.
Right. And you know, he, when my uncle died, President Johnson switched back to that old foreign policy.
Yep.
And he brought a guy in called Thomas Mann, who had relationships with the intelligence community and with the oil interests and mining interests, in to run the Alliance for Progress. And my father was very upset about that, and he made that visit in 64 65, to Brazil, to Peru, to Chile, to the other Latin American countries. And he said to them, you know, you are in charge of your own future. If you don't like Anaconda wire and cable running your country, or AT&T, you should have a revolution against them. And that shocked everybody, but it was something that he believed in, and that he believed that these nations should have sovereignty and that they should dictate their own future, and that that would make a much stronger partnership with the United States.
Mr. Secretary, if we might delve a little bit into the personal side and political side of things, how about we just go for a brief stroll down recent memory lane, back to August 23rd, 2024, in Glendale, Arizona, when you endorsed President Trump, and that took many by surprise for sure. Could you walk us through behind the scenes of that day and what Did you actually consider, electorally speaking, the calculus that you made? And particularly, and I got to hand it to you, how the class act that you were from that point on, and even before that, but to this day, even against the backlash coming from many of your siblings and relatives?
I mean, you know, I did something that was unpopular with a lot of people who were lifelong friends and family, but it was something that I thought was best for our country. And, you know, I had started out in the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party basically changed the rules to make it so that there's no way that I could win. And I'll give you an example. They passed a rule because I had been campaigning in New Hampshire, which is the first state to have a primary. And so the Democratic Party passed a rule that said that anybody who sets foot into New Hampshire cannot get any delegates from New Hampshire. And they were doing that all along. They made it literally impossible. I could have won 80% of the vote, and I would have still lost the convention. And so that, you know, people had given their lives and had given huge amounts of money to my campaign.
And you almost made to that first debate. You almost hit the 15% mark, although the media pool, they clearly subverted the criteria in order to avoid your presence there. That would have been a first since 1996, right, with Ross Perot's second and final candidacy as a independent candidate, right?
Yeah.
Were you frustrated about that? I'm sure you were.
I was, you know, what I was doing was making decisions based upon the world that was given to me.
Yep.
And the facts on the ground were what they were, that the media would not cover my campaign. And I'm not complaining about it. It was just a fact of life. So for me to accomplish my agenda as best I could,
you had to go for
it. The best strategy was to merge my campaign with President Trump's.
And when that happened, did an interview where you mentioned how you discovered a more empathetic side to President Trump. Other than that, your relationship with him spans many decades, but you've become closer and, of course, have this working relationship since February 23rd, if I'm not mistaken, when you were confirmed. Other than that, how have you been dealing with him, and what have you discovered about him that you didn't know before?
Well, I've spoken about my changing impression of President Trump. I accepted the mainstream media portrait of him as kind of a bombastic narcissist who didn't read books, who was ignorant of most affairs, who was impulsive. And, you know, I found somebody who's completely different than that, somebody who's extraordinarily empathetic. That he thinks about other people and the impacts. You know, I've spoken about the fact that every time he mentions the war in Ukraine, he mentions the casualties on both sides of the war. And whenever he talks about almost any issue of consequence, he talks about the impacts on human beings. So he cares about people. He's kind. It's in his personal relationships. He's been very, very kind to me, to my family, to my wife, to my children. And also, he's extraordinarily knowledgeable. And, you know,
he's a student of history, right?
He's a student of history. And, you know, anybody who saw his interview this week, where he went through the portraits in the Oval Office during the cabinet meeting and talked a little bit about each president, can show that, you know, can get a display of his curiosity and his knowledge. But he has encyclopedic knowledge about music, about sports, about UFC fighting and about boxing and about a lot of other issues. I was on an airplane with him at one point, and he was talking about the Mideast. And he put it, he asked for a piece of paper, and then he drew a map, a perfect map of the Mideast. He has a very good hand. And with all the nations and the troop strength in each nation, and that's something that I think does not fit into the public narrative about President Trump. He's very thoughtful. He's strategic in his thinking. And, you know, a lot of what he does may seem impulsive, but if you look at the long-term good of our country, it's not good to have a trade deficit of $1.2 trillion a year. It's existential, and we can't continue. And the tariffs, maybe people would say, well, you should have done it over a longer period of time. But President Trump knows that he only has 4 years and that most of the things that he accomplishes are going to be in his first year. And so he's acting very, very fast. And this is true on all of these issues. He feels an urgency. And he acts quickly, and he acts decisively, and he knows what he wants. And, I respect that. I think he's looking at the long-term good of America, which very few politicians do.
So, Secretary Kennedy, I know life must seem overwhelming given the dynamics of politics and all of the horse trading, all of the pressures. But what keeps you grounded today in 2025? Is it still your faith, the outdoors? Is it your wife, Cheryl? Is it your 6 children, Bobby the Third, Kick, Connor, Kira, Finn, and Aiden? How would you, or all
and
of them,
Kat,
I guess,
yeah.
And Kat as well?
It's all those things. I mean, I try to live a balanced life, and I try to be centered when I approach life. I do meditations every morning. I do exercise every day, and I try to make sure that I'm living in the higher vibrations, and that I have, that I make decisions based upon what I think is the right thing to do rather than what, other people want me to do.
Fantastic. Now to really wrap up the interview, your reflections on your relationship to God was one of the most well-posited and well-thought-out reflections I've ever seen. Would you mind, just for our Brazilian audience and the Brazilian wider public, which is very much Catholic, your uncle, the 35th president, John F. Kennedy, he was the first Roman Catholic president, as we know, as Roman Catholicism is so prevalent in Brazil. A quick mention about that?
Because of my own struggle with addiction, the part of overcoming that struggle was developing, what I would say is kind of a conscious contact with my God, and trying not to live my life based upon, addiction is about self-obsession, and it's about living an ego-driven life. And in order to recover, you really have to make a transition and say, I'm going to live for some other purpose. And that I'm going to... And the way that you do that is by trying to stay in a posture of surrender, of constantly saying, am I doing the thing that God wants me to do right now? And if you're not, then having the discipline to change what you're doing. And if you are, then trying to be content within yourself and trying to be grateful. Try to maintain that posture of surrender. I think most of us think about God when we're in a lot of trouble. And, it's like a foxhole prayer.
Yep.
And addiction put me into that kind of trouble so that, I was willing to say, okay, the way that I'm living my life is not working. I need to let somebody else run my life. But then, when your life starts to get better, and the cash and prizes start flowing in, I think all of us have the inclination to say, thank you, God, I got it from here, and then take the wheel of the car and drive it off a cliff again. And the big challenge is staying in that posture of surrender, even when everything's going well, and connecting into that higher power and letting providence steer your life rather than ego.
Thank you so much, Secretary Kennedy. It's an honor. Thank you.
You too. I'm looking forward to coming to Brazil. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.